Hey, welcome to the amazing Dogs Are Smarter Than People bonus interview with an author or a writer. And Ellen Borum is here, and she is both of those things. Ellen.
Worry.
I'm not even going to edit that out, honestly, because people are so used to me messing everything up. But Ellen is one of the most amazing humans I've ever met, and was once my boss, but hopefully we won't talk about that. And
no one's your boss, Carrie. No one.
Is that really the impression I give? Oh, no. Oh, that's interesting. I'm the least self-aware human ever. Anyways, Ellen was this amazing person in the newsroom, just a great, brilliant writer and so insightful about other humans, which I think is part of the reason she was such a great writer in the news world. And another reason why she's such a great writer as she transitioned to the world of middle grade. Officially, Ellen, on your website, I'm going to quote here, Ellen spent 19 years as a small town journalist before quitting her job, which I kind of followed her footsteps, to write three award-winning fantasies for readers age 10 and older. Is it four award-winning?
Four.
I'm like, I'm pretty sure that last one is.
Four.
So those are The Unnameables, Small Persons with Wings, Texting the Underworld, and the book we're going to talk a tiny bit about today is River Magic, which came out in April of 2021. And Ellen not only writes books, but writing has taken over at least a part of her time and soul, because she also does this amazing work volunteering for writing as a writing coach for students in, is it Brooklyn?
In
Brooklyn, Maine, which is her community. And she also started Word. It's Word, right?
Yeah, I was just trying to think of a way to work that in.
We can talk about that way too, which is the annual Blue Hill, Maine Literary Arts Festival. Ellen lives in Brooklyn with her partner, painter Robert. I don't know how to say Rob's last name.
Shillity?
Yeah. Wow. I just fail at the names. You know why? Because in the newspaper world, I didn't care about saying them. I just wanted to make sure I spelled them correctly so that Ellen didn't get angry at me.
Exactly.
Yeah. See, you've
when you're a reader, you often don't know how to pronounce things because, you know, you read stuff, but you pronounce it in your head and then you never talk about it. So
ever.
You discover that all these years you've been pronouncing something wrong.
Can you think of a word that you've been doing wrong?
I remember in high school, my friend and I would talk about Nietzsche and Goethe.
It's so beautiful. That's so funny. You grew up in coastal Mass, right, Ellen?
Yeah.
That's where you're from. And if I remember, and now you're in coastal Maine, so you're in the coastal places. And River Magic also has this element of, you know, it's a river, but it's the edge of that liminal space between land and water.
Right.
And I was kind of wondering if you think that you're drawn to those things and if that's part of why you write fantasy for middle grade too, because your fantasies are so contemporary yet also fantastic. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of those spaces where things touch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, the ocean has always seemed to me like an escape hatch. I mean, I tried it at one point, experimented with moving to Minnesota, and I felt claustrophobic, which is really, really weird because, you know, there's nothing claustrophobic about Minnesota. There's these wide open spaces. And in fact, my father came from Minnesota and felt claustrophobic in Massachusetts because he couldn't see the weather coming because it always west and, you know, there were trees in the way. But, yeah, I mean, there's definitely something. I think we came from water. Let's face it. I mean, there's something, you know, some old home week thing going on with us in water, I think. You know, there's just, I mean, we love to float. We love. I mean, and it's a completely foreign world if you go underneath.
And
for most of us, it's beyond understanding. And you know, those are all elements of fantasy for sure.
Yeah, they definitely are. It's so funny.
Fantasy because it's a little twist on reality, and it makes you look at things in an entirely different way. And especially if you're like me and you have reality and you mix your fantasy with reality, with the real reality based story. And I think that's a lot of what water does for us too. It's a whole different world. I mean, you're out in a boat or something, and it's like, at least for those of us who don't spend our lives on the water, which, you know, it's a whole different world.
And it's, you know, like you're saying, a whole different world, but also within your world and, mm-hmm. and touching your world. And that's really cool to think about. Yeah. Your imagination is always so funny and clever and big. And I was thinking and reading about, like, your formative time, like, as baby Ellen, which I wish I got to see. Not like... I'm 6 months old, Ellen, and I'm in diapers, but like your youth, like before you came to Maine, and how, I think on your website, it talks about as well that you were next door neighbors to Alton Hall Blackington.
Yes.
And he was this huge personality, right? Yeah. And like this photographer and this writer, and I think I didn't know, but apparently had some issues with his chimney. And I was wondering if, like, you know, we always talk about how our parents impact our writing, and well, a lot of us do, or give us neuroses. That would be me. But I feel like how can you quantify or even mention how Alton made a big impact on you as a kid?
Blackie. You do not call him Alton.
Thank God. His ghost. He's going to come hurt me, isn't he?
Yeah, right. He definitely is. If anybody will, it's him.
Yeah.
Unfortunately he died when I was about 12. So, but I loved him to death. Before that. And, he had a dragon in his attic. And I completely believe that. And even though I had actually been, his attic was his office, and I had actually been up there with my mother, because he tape recorded me a few times, because I don't know why, he just did it. He'd like to, you know, ask kids questions and get them on tape and giving cute answers. but I was up there with my mother, I would hasten to say. He wasn't that, you know, it wasn't like that. He wrote these Yankee yarns that were all mostly things like, the great molasses disaster of Boston, where everybody drowned in molasses, but
it's amazing.
And some of them were, you had a little supernatural element to them. As I recall, I haven't read them for years, but he just had that little twist on his life. I mean, when we moved into that house, I was 2 years old, I'm running around kicking leaves. My mother, is, you know, harried with the movers and everything. And there's this old man leaning on the fence, and he says, and she says, "Hello." And he says, "You know, it's haunted, don't you?" And so that was him. I mean, he just, you know, there was all, you know, and when I was a kid, he would just ask you these questions that just had a twist.
Yeah.
You know, like, you went to the fair, did you see the skeleton in the church basement? You know, I mean, that, it was just, you know, so probably he did have a formative effect.
Yeah, because I think that you have that little twist in conversation and in story too. Mm-hmm. Like your brain goes to these cool places that not everybody else's brain might automatically go to, but then you're brave enough to say it, which is always an extra, like, you don't find all that many people like that. I think there is, you know, maybe one other person that we worked with at the paper who did that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it's always so refreshing and intriguing, and it lights up not just the room and the world that you're in, but also the page that you're on. And I think that's one of the reasons your books are so cool. Was it scary to leave the newspaper world and go into the world of fiction?
Oh,
where you
gotcha.
Don't have to, yeah. Leaving the world of planning board meetings and going into the world of magic.
When I left the American, I had a month in which I was freelancing for the American because I was doing a series for them. And then after that, I was set free. And the third day, I happily writing away for 3 days. And the third day, 2 days. And the third day, I woke up and I sat down at my computer and I had no idea what to write. I drew a complete blank. And I thought, I've just completely upended my entire life. I'm 52 years old. I have quit my job to do this and I can't do it. Oh my God. And that was terrifying. And
well, you were wrong.
I don't know what made me do this, but I backed out of the document and opened a new document and started writing a journal in the voice of my main character. Huh. And that's been my fallback ever since, because within half an hour, I knew, and all I was writing about was like what he had for breakfast and, you know, what he was going to do that day and that kind of stuff. And by the end of the of a half an hour, I knew what he was about, you know, and so I knew where his story was going to go. And, you know, my editor at who's now unfortunately left the business, my beloved Kathy Dawson, said to me once, anytime you're stuck, it's because you don't know your character well enough. And that's absolutely true. And that's what I've found out ever since.
So for you, when you're stuck, and for a lot of us, it's a character stuck. Mm-hmm. And like the emotional through line of the story, or just something mm-hmm. like you don't understand fully yet about their motivations or their
right.
goals, or like the darkness that they're afraid of inside of them. Ooh, that's when.
Yeah.
Negative. But like,
well, you know, we all have darkness inside of us. I mean, you have to
in order to have
knowledge that, and yeah. you know, it would be stupid not to.
Exactly. And so for you, like, I think for a lot of writers, that's a really good tip, is to, when you're blocked, think about that. And for you, the way that you can deal with that and dive deeper and dig deeper into who your character is through that. Mm-hmm. journaling, even if it's about their breakfast.
Right. And the important thing is that it be stream of consciousness. I mean, it just, you know, you're not directing it in any way, and you're just,
yeah.
I always tell the kids at school that there's this little guy, there's this locked room in the back of your head. And there's a little guy in there typing away and he knows the whole story, but he's behind a locked door. And so everything you do, everything, all of the tricks that we use to get ourselves going are all about getting him to just open that door for a second and let something out, you know? And so it's all just a way to kind of relax and relax your brain and let what's already in there come out and come to the fore.
That's very cool, actually. So there was this book by a psychic guy like in the 1980s or 70s that I was in love. Oh, it was for the 80s that I was in love with. And he always talked about the little guy in the back
oh, really?
Of your head. Yeah. And I never hear anybody else talking about that. But he was just like, there are file cabinets back there
exactly.
storing everything.
Yeah,
that's so cool. Is that one of the biggest tips that you give the kids that you're working with?
I think the biggest tip is be mean to your character. That's the one that seems to resonate with them. And after a while you have to end up having, you know, by the time they get to, I work with middle school kids. So sometimes this year it's 6, 7, and 8, but sometimes it starts as early as 5th grade. And by the time they reach 8th grade, they're doing horrible things to their character. And I'm like, okay, tone it down a little bit.
I was working with some kids at the Connors Emerson School, which is where mm-hmm. I live in Bar Harbor. And one of the kids, I was just like, wow. I mean, they must have studied with you ahead of time, Ellen, because that character was like kidnapped by aliens and then dogs went after it and they went home. Everybody's dead at home. Like it was just one huge catastrophe.
The other thing I think is important to that is that if you're really, if you're going to torture your character, the way to do it is to have something horrible happen to someone they love, not to them, you know, because that's really, I mean, if you read like Harry Potter, I mean, the worst things that happen to him are the things that, that happen to people he loves. I mean, somebody who even die in places. And, and having, you know, you never really see Harry, you know, you're, it's not that often that Harry is actually physically tortured himself.
Right.
You know, it's always that something's happening to someone else that that really, really gets under his skin.
And that's what happens in your last book, too. Like in I have it right here. Ooh. Oh, it's pretty for those of you who can see this and aren't just listening. You make some terrible, terrible things happen even before the book has started for poor Donna. And it's sad and mean, Ellen. You're so mean. But at the same time, it's brilliant writing. And I'm just going to quickly embarrass you by saying Publishers Weekly said it has a dense emotional core, a resonant voice, and the themes of grief and shifting friendships and family enliven Borum's contemporary fantasy, reminding readers that, quote, hope is everywhere. Was that your theme? Was hope is everywhere part of like your intentional theme?
Probably,
for her story?
Yeah, probably ends up being the theme. Yeah, it wasn't really my. Well, I mean, anytime you're writing for middle grade, especially, or kid, you know, younger than YA, I guess, you always know your character is going to kind of come out okay, and will have. And everything won't be solved. I mean, by any means. I mean, I actually make a point of not solving everything at the end of a book. But your character will have grown and learned and will know more about him or herself. And I can't remember where this started. River Magic was originally because I always start with the first thing that comes to mind is always the supernatural character. And then I end up with a human character whose problems match, and then it becomes the human character's story. And so in this case, some kids at school had been written a couple of companion stories in which the protagonists were dragons, and they had so much fun that I thought, I want to write about a dragon, and what's more, I want to ride a dragon.
want to ride a dragon.
I started basically with a dragon and ended up with a river dragon. And so I kept thinking, okay, what do we know about dragons? And mostly what I thought of was anger, you know, that there would be anger in this dragon. So I thought, okay, I'm going to throw everything in the book at my character and she's going to get angry. And she didn't. This is what happened. The person who got angry was her sister, you know, and she, you know, Donna doesn't have time to get, she's too busy solving things. She doesn't have time to get angry, and she gets a little angry at the end and it actually helps her. But most of the time she's just, you know, she's just trying to cope, and her, and part of what she's trying to cope with is her sister being so angry. Where did this start? Oh, yes. I guess I wanted Donna to end the book with hope. I guess I did. And hope is everywhere is something that I better not say, but it's something that is said to Donna about halfway through the book.
Yeah. And it lends itself really well to that without spoiling things, because of, here, I'll do it without spoiling things, because of the genre and because that positive transformation arc is so cool and fits so perfectly with the genre. I also wanted to say we all wanted to ride dragons, but also it seems like maybe I don't know if this happened before you worked for newspapers or and it's just innate in you, but it seems like you're such an observational person that you a lot of the times you, the people that who are around you, make their way in little and bigger ways into your stories and your work. Mm-hmm. They kind of, do you think that is a thing that happens? Like you get inspired by those kids all the time. And
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and one of the, I discover what kids really want to read by what they write.
Yeah, that's true.
And that kind of gets embedded in my head at some point.
That's sneaky.
Although I have to say, judging from last year, what kids want is for the hero to die at the end.
I have noticed that a lot too. I've noticed that so much.
Sometimes it's because they can't think of any other conclusion, so they just kill everybody off. But my favorite was a kid who years ago, he had this character, this main character who was really bad. He was a bad person. And throughout the story, you couldn't figure out who you were supposed to identify with because this guy was so bad. And he ended up throwing himself out of a skyscraper. And on his way down, he realized the error of his ways.
Oh, no.
Not a hero. And I love that so much.
I bet you did. That's awesome. And like, it is in a weird way, kind of, okay.
Yeah, it's fine. Gonna... It was fine. It was a great story. I mean, he completely pulled it together at the end.
And it makes me think of like your story too, not the flinging off the building, but like how you just kind of were like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to leave this newspaper world behind. Mm-hmm. And go and confront the world of fiction.
It was a moment of madness. It was madness. It was midlife crisis to the nth degree. I woke up the morning after my last day at the paper and thought, what have I done? And that happened when we moved to Maine. I mean, back in 1984, I remember we worked really hard. We took years to find the right place and get here and make it possible. And I woke up the first morning and looked out the window and there are these marching fir trees. And I thought, oh my God, what have I done? and within a year I was griping because we could see another house. I adapted, but you know, every time there's one of these big major changes in my life, I start by saying, oh no, what have I done?
You do. You take big leaps, Ellen. You take
I know.
Big leaps. And I think that's pretty inspiring for the rest of us. I can't remember if I took my big leap after you and quit the newspaper world or not. I think
I think you were before me. I think I was still working at the American, wasn't I, when you went to
grad school? Yeah, I don't remember. I know that you thought about it in 2003 when you took the Cindy Thayer fiction workshop,
right?
You didn't do it in 2000.
No, I didn't. Oh, yeah, I did. I quit my job in 2003.
Oh, then you were before me.
But then I didn't get published until that. I mean, my book came out in 2008. Yeah. So it took me 5 years to get... it's very interesting because when I quit my job, I said, okay, I hadn't written a word of the novel at that point. I mean, not a word. And, I had a version of it in a drawer, from, 20 years before, but it was
That's
horrible.
Amazing.
I had to start all over. And so it took me until I basically said I put aside a chunk of money and I said, okay, I'm either going to use up this money or 5 years. Once this money is gone or it's been 5 years, I have to go back and find a job. And my book came out 5 years to the day.
That's amazing.
My job.
So. That's amazing. I gave myself, I think to the end of graduate school plus 6 months is what I said. I was like, nope. I can't do this forever. Yeah. I have to either like I can't because money, et cetera. And
so
I have
what
to
year
do
did you go? What year did you go to Vermont?
I think I went to Vermont in 2005.
Oh, okay. So it was well after I left the American then. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know what I'm
what
terrible
were you doing
at dates.
2003.
What?
What were you doing in 2003?
I was in charge of the weekly.
Okay.
So weekly.
Okay. All right.
I think. But I'm really terrible. I'm terrible, terrible, terrible with years. Like, yeah. I'm so bad.
Oh, so I guess I do go first.
Maybe we could just pretend we went at the same time because I'm really not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm only figuring out when I went to Vermont, judging by when my first book came out. So it's all tangled. Yeah. Yeah. Might have been 2004. Anyways, no one cares. No one cares about that except me. Before we go, I want to ask you a couple more things that I think are important and interesting and maybe be helpful for other people too. What is like the bravest thing you think you do as a writer?
The bravest thing? Probably sit down at the desk in the morning. That's really the critical thing, is to just sit down and open the document, and every morning you open the document and you think, this is the day I'm not going to be able to write. You know, this is the day when it's all going to collapse, and you start writing. You know, that's it. You know, and it's something that I've learned now that I wish I had learned when I was 20.
Yeah.
but you know, at least I learned it at some point.
Do you feel like you battled your nature a little bit as a writer?
God, yes. I mean, I am the world's laziest person. I'm very lazy. Left to myself, I would sit and watch videos all day. And I wouldn't even read. I would just completely veg out. And
I never would imagine that.
Oh, totally. Totally.
My taskmaster, my editor, my like.
I put up a good front, but.
Oh my gosh!
I'm battling my procrastinating nature all my life, And it's my biggest enemy is my tendency to procrastinate.
And how do you overcome that? Because you've made these four beautiful books.
Shame. I mean, actually, I have to say. That living with Rob Shillity was critical because he's a painter, but he keeps, he's always kept banker's hours. I mean, he gets up in the morning, he gets into the studio. It used to be 7 o'clock. Now it's more like 8 o'clock. He comes up for a break. He goes out for lunch. He comes up for lunch and walks the dog. He comes up at 4 to light a fire in the wood stove. And, you know, it's like completely methodical. And I would have been embarrassed not to get my work done, you know, when I was working with him. So shame is really important.
So we all need a good chunk of shame.
Shame and guilt, you know, those good emotions.
Yeah. Is it hard having two creative people in the house, or do you think you feed off of each other?
No, I don't know what it would be like if we were both writers or both painters, but the writing and the painting work really, I mean, we both have, neither one of us knows a lot about the other's craft. And so, so we're very good, sounding boards, you know. I mean, I'm the one who says, you know, I'm not talking about composition or any of that stuff. I'm the one who says that hand looks funny. And he's the one who says, this doesn't, I can't remember who this person is. Maybe you should tell me, maybe you should remind me who this person is by this page. You know, that kind of thing. So yeah, and it works really well.
And you've surrounded yourself with a community of writers. Like Word is kind of a part of that too.
Trying to figure out how I was going to get the conversation back to Word.
Psychically linked there.
Which is online this year, October 21st through 24th. The website is wordfestival.org.
Cool.
And if you go there, you find out all about the wonderful things that are going to be online for Word. And they include author talks. We have Susan Choi and Bob Keys, who wrote about Robert Indiana, which is very popular subject around here. We have poets. We have four workshops, poetry, memoir, fiction, and flash fiction.
Cool.
And a panel of cookbook writers, of food writers. So it's a very much smaller. We only decided to go online about a couple of weeks ago. And so everything, we're rushing. It's very frustrating because we had the whole thing planned in March. And all then just, you know, the past 3 weeks, we've been running around reorganizing it, changing the timing, making sure everybody's okay with being online, sure we don't overlap because we didn't feel like people wanted to be on Zoom all of their lives.
All about the Zoom. What was the founding, like the, why, what compelled you all? Because you were one of the founding members to start Word.
It was all because of Sarah Pebworth, who is an innkeeper and had just sold her inn. And she's also our state rep from the Blue Hill area. And she, as an innkeeper, she had been wishing, first of all, she's a reader. And so she had been wishing that there were a literary festival somewhere. Oh. And also she, and she's a writer. She's, you know, she's reader and writer. And, but as an innkeeper, she had been wishing there would be, there could be more of a shoulder season in Bluebell. So that's part of, that was part of what we were thinking about when we first started. That's why it's at the end of October, because we're trying to stretch things out, because there's a food and wine festival and there's a poetry festival in Belfast. And so we thought, you know, we'll just stretch it a little, one more week. And we always try to have something that gets people out into the community. This year it's, we have poetry postcards in businesses so that people can, you know, write a poem on the back of there's prompts and you write a poem on the back of the postcard and either mail it or drop it at Blue Hill Books.
That's amazing.
just a way to get people out into businesses in Blue Hill.
Oh, that's so cool. Area.
It's going to be Hancock. So there'll be some in Bar Harbor, I think.
Oh, and, yay.
And Hancock County and probably as far as field as far as far afield as Belfast.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah.
Ellen, thank you so much for being here. And before you go, do you want to pitch anything else other than Word? And I'll have a link to that site in your own website.
Oh, good.
In the podcast notes and everywhere this shows up. So, but is there something specifically you'd like to pitch or tell us about? Do you have a new project secretly on your computer?
Well, I'm writing a book about the son of a Valkyrie. But that's not going to hit the stands for quite a while. So no, Word is the important thing. Word is the
most important. That's amazing. Yeah. Word is the important thing.
Yeah, right now, it's word, word, word all the time.
Aww. And then you'll miss it in November.
Yeah, no, I won't.
Do you miss the newspaper world? Do you ever miss being a reporter?
Yes, I do. Don't you?
All the time.
Yeah. I mean, there's the camaraderie and I mean, a newsroom. You know, it's just, it takes a long time to get used to working in a newsroom and it takes a long time to get it out of your blood. I mean, it's, I do. I definitely miss it.
Yeah, I miss that camaraderie, and I miss I miss learning, like being forced to learn about things I never would want to learn, like land use ordinances or shoreback regulations. No offense to them, but like just these things that I never would have delved into if I hadn't been forced to via having to write a story.
And it definitely uses a different part of your brain that I'm not using. You know, it's a kind of an analytical. forceful kind of part of your brain that is getting soft.
Yeah. But I bet, like, I know it's made us better writers as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because,
I mean,
you know,
there's nothing like a school board meeting to make you a miniaturist, you know? I mean, part of it is that as newspaper people, we had to write visually in order to compete with TV. Right. And so, you know, it was incredible training and writing, you know, and putting you in the place and giving you a sense of what the atmosphere was and all that kind of stuff. It's great training.
I feel so ignorant because I never really thought about it that way, about how it does make you a visual writer and exactly for the reasons why. Mm-hmm. You're so smart, Ellen. You're still teaching me. And thank you so much for being there. And everyone should check out Word and also check out Ellen's books because you will not be disappointed. She is brilliant and amazing and full of heart, all combined in this ridiculously cool package. So thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Carrie. Great to see your face again.
Yeah, you too.